Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Sloan. If you like watching YouTube science videos like I do, you've probably gotten your fill of Grammarly commercials and such, but one set that never bothers me are the ads for Generation Genius science education videos featuring Dr. Jeff and his pair of enthusiastic kid scientist actors. After actually using some of his videos in my classroom a few years ago, I became intrigued to find out more about him. And I was also interested to learn that Vinokur is a real scientist with a PhD in biochemistry from UCLA. And before founding Generation Genius, he combined his love of modern dance moves with his passion for science to create the persona of the dancing scientist, taking his roadshow to schools around the country, as well as appearances on national TV shows like Today and Rachel Ray. It's part classic Mr. Wizard science demonstrations combined with dance moves that he honed during his high school and college days in Wisconsin. I know from visiting with elementary school teachers over the years that science education at the K-8 level across the country is uneven at best, with teachers that have limited training in science and are hard-pressed to fit science into their classrooms on a regular basis. But Vinokur is hoping to help with his Generation Genius videos and supplementary materials for the classroom. His onstage and camera persona is high energy and engaging, but I wanted to get to know the real person that is Dr. Jeff Vinokur, so I reached out and he agreed to join us from his headquarters in Los Angeles. So without further ado, Dr. Jeff Vinokur, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks, Dave. It's great to be with you.
Well, I'd like to know, you know, if you don't mind me asking, how old are you now?
I just turned 30, big 30.
Still a very young man. You're half my age. I'd like to know, as a child, how did you first get interested in science? Because it literally is your life now. How did you first get interested in science?
So I was one of those weird kids, I guess, where I was just always into science. And the best example of that is I actually had a lab in my garage as a kid. So I had a gas mask, you know, big gloves, foldable table, bunch of glassware, and I did all kinds of science experiments in that lab. So that's everything from growing sugar crystals and other substances to some really dangerous experiments. I'll give you an example of one. I tried to make sodium metal, and that's cool because it bursts into flames when you put it in water. And I couldn't buy it because I was, you know, a kid and nobody was going to sell it to me. And so to make it, you basically take drain opener crystals and you heat it until it melts. So you basically have molten drain opener, and then you run electricity through it from a 12-volt car battery using basically coat hangers as the electrodes. And, you know, it would be splattering all over the place. It's pretty dangerous, but very exciting. And those kinds of experiences just helped get me further and further into science.
Oh my gosh, Jeff, that really is a dangerous experiment to do as a kid.
Don't try this at home. I think we should mention that.
I'm just going to, you know, please, you know, parents, you can get your kid a lab and do the sugar crystals and stuff, but the making sodium, leave that to people like Jeff.
Kids, don't be like me when you were a kid.
I will tell you from a teacher's, you know, a chemistry teacher, the one question you just hate hearing, and you hear it all the time, is, do we get to blow stuff up in here? And you just want to say, no, stop asking that. But you get to blow things up, Jeff. It's okay. You're one of the few people that it's all right that you do that.
Thank you.
You do it carefully. Okay, so you're interested in science. You're doing all these DIY stuff in your garage. And then you must have decided pretty early on you're going to be a scientist. So tell us about how you decided on your major and to go to college, because you went, what, to the University of Wisconsin at Madison?
Yes, that's right. So as I was saying, I've always been into science my whole life. And even before I had a lab in my garage, which was kind of like late middle school, early high school, I was just doing like kitchen experiments, you know, slime and all kinds of stuff like that. Then it advanced to a garage lab doing mostly chemistry. And then from there, I went and did research in the summers, first at Rutgers University in New Jersey, and then at Penn State. So while a lot of kids were, you know, going to, you know, camp and stuff in the summer and relaxing, I was working in the lab starting probably around 16 years old, doing research on biofuels and studying photosynthesis and things like that. And then that's kind of what made me get into biochemistry, which is what I ended up majoring in at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, was doing research there since my very first day on campus. Actually, the way I picked the school was I looked at the funding for the National Science Foundation, like which university has the most research going on. And University of Wisconsin-Madison was always kind of the top of the list, you know, right next to the kind of the Harvards and stuff, and couldn't get into Harvard, right? So figured University of Wisconsin is where I should go. And after that, did another four to five years of my PhD at UCLA, also studying biochemistry.
Let's back up a bit. While you were at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, you got interested in dance, and I'd like to know how that happened.
Yeah, so the dance definitely bloomed when I was in college, but it started a little bit before that in high school, and I always liked watching break dancers and stuff like that, and I had kind of dabbled with it. And I was just always fascinated by it. But, you know, I was a science kid and I always did science and there was no time for it. But that, I guess the dancing stemmed from a way that I was able to cope with. You know, like my parents got divorced when I was around 18 years old. And, you know, for any kid, it was tough. And, you know, some people do pottery or play guitar to kind of find their outlet for, you know, those feelings. And the outlet I found was learning to dance. You know, at those times, I couldn't really concentrate on doing science experiments and reading a textbook and stuff. And so that was kind of an outlet. And because of that, I practice a lot every single day. And I made YouTube videos that became popular. Today, they have 25 million YouTube views from, you know, performances and tutorials and things. Mm-hmm. And so kind of dance was, at the beginning, it was just I was scientist by day, dancer by night. They were completely separate things. And later at the University of Wisconsin, they got combined to become the dancing scientist. And that's kind of what snowballed into where we are today.
Yeah, well, I'd kind of like to know how that happened. I'm wondering if this is apocryphal or a true story. Was it you were on an airline flight and some passenger sitting next to you suggested that you combine it? How did you figure out to combine your two loves of dance and science?
Sure. Well, it was always, people would always make a joke like, you know, you're like a dancing scientist if they knew that I did science and dance. And it was always kind of like a little joke. And I didn't really think much of it. But I had this idea to try to make a performance out of combining science and dance. And I try to be friendly and talk to people if I'm in a taxi or an airplane, you know, just chat up the person next to you or the driver and hear their story. And I was just, you know, flying, I forget if it was either to college or back from college. And I sat next to a person that did like programs for schools. And I told them about, you know, this dancing and science you're doing. So like, that's a great idea for like a performance, like to go and perform at schools and stuff like that. And so that kind of was, it's not like he created the idea, but it was that person saying that there was something there that was the catalyst for making me go for it. Like the idea was, I already had the idea, but I needed a little push. And that was that little bit of activation energy that got me over the bump.
Yeah. And I love how you're using biochemistry analogies to explain it, because I totally get that. When you went to UCLA, before we get on to the dancing scientist, when you get on stage and the big stage, you got your education paid for there?
Yeah, I was lucky to have funding from the National Science Foundation. There's this award called the Graduate Research Fellowship, which the majority of graduate students apply for. It's very competitive. And if you get it, it basically covers all of your schooling. And I was lucky enough to get that award, which fully covered my graduate education, basically a full scholarship. And it also gave me the freedom to explore these other interests I had while being a graduate student. You know, typically when you're a grad student, you know, you're working 80 hours a week in the lab and there's no time for anything else. But having this award pay for all of my schooling kind of granted me some flexibility to, you know, I was still doing those kinds of hours in the lab. But on top of that, I was, exploring this this dancing sciences thing that was going on.
Yeah. And that's wonderful. I'm so glad to hear that, because I love to see somebody be able to live out their dreams and have their education paid for, because, you know, somebody like you totally deserves that, you know, not just athletes and football players at UCLA, but UCLA is a great science school as well as being, you know, a Pac-12 powerhouse in NCAA sports. But now I'd like to know, when did you start, you know, doing your shtick where you started doing this, you know, really, you know, performing for, was performing for schools first, or, you know, how do you get from there to the big stage where you're on the Today Show and, you know, Fox and all of the morning shows, and you're appearing on Rachel Ray and things like that? How was the bridge from, you know, where you were at UCLA to get to the big time, as it were?
Thank you. Yeah. So it actually started when I was at the University of Wisconsin when I was an undergraduate student. And so I had a mentor at the University of Wisconsin. There's a guy there, a professor there by the name of Bassam Shakashiri. And he's the person who wrote the books on chemistry demonstrations. So yes, all these experiments that we do, a lot of them are traced back to his books. And so, you know, I had this idea to combine dancing and science. I sent him an email. He was interested in helping me out a little bit. And he connected me with the person that does the lecture demonstrations there. So when you're in chemistry 101 and the professor wants to do some experiments, there was a guy there by the name of Jim Maynard who prepares those experiments. And he was willing to let me work in the demo lab, as we called it, and prepare experiments and figure this all out. So I did have definitely some mentorship at the beginning. But for me, it was a backwards process. Usually you spend many years working your way up to getting on TV. For me, it was actually the opposite. It actually started from a big TV show, America's Got Talent. And that's what led to everything else. So I had been contacted by some scouts from America's Got Talent. This is probably in like 2011 or something like that. They basically scour the internet looking for acts that have millions of YouTube views to bring on their show. And they reached out to me and I went and auditioned and I didn't make it. And I wasn't that upset me a little bit. I didn't like to be to fail like that. So the next year I went back to them with this crazy idea. I'm going to combine dancing and science. The act was called at that time, The Dancing Mad Scientist. Things are exploding and changing colors and fizzing and popping and floating. And I'm doing this hip hop dancing at the same time. It sounded crazy and it was, but they loved the concept. And I made the top 100 out of 70,000 auditions for America's Got Talent season 5, got to go to Vegas. And that was a backup for the live rounds. I didn't get to the live rounds, but at least it was, you know, I was in the commercials. I had some screen time and I could say, as seen on America's Got Talent. And that's what kind of started the snowball rolling for me. Because of that, I got, you know, a lot of local press in Madison, Wisconsin. I got on the local news in Madison, Wisconsin. I did really well the first segment and they had me back every month. So, you know, there I was, a 20-year-old kid having a monthly science segment on the 6 a.m. news there. And from there, it just snowballed. Then it went to Discovery Channel in Canada, which had me do a bunch of segments. And then from there, it snowballed to regional shows like Home and Family, Home and Family on the Hallmark Channel. Well, I guess it's a national show, but maybe not as well known as the others. And then that snowballs to the Today Show, then Rachel Ray, then Weather Channel, and then everybody keeps calling you back. And that snowball I just described is many years, but that's basically, you just roll the snowball.
Yeah, well, and you know, I've seen many clips from those, and they're wonderful. And I was going to ask you, you know, where, because you do all of these, what I would consider a lot of them are classic demonstrations that, you know, I had those books by Professor Shakashiri as a chemistry teacher years ago in high school. I used those books because I didn't, you know, I had no idea. So I'd look up, you know, what do I do for this unit to make kids go, ooh, wow, look at that. And you do some of the classics like the iodine clock reaction that you did. I think that was on the Today Show or one of those. Yes. That was just beautiful. Could you describe for our listeners that particular demonstration?
Sure. So the iodine clock reaction is basically when you mix a couple of reagents and there's a delay before a reaction happens. So the liquids start clear. And you mix them together and it stays clear. And after a certain number of seconds, the reaction is completed and it changes to black. I think the reaction details are quite advanced. But basically that was the demonstration from the book. And I do a lot of classic demonstrations. I mean, it's not like I am creating all of these from scratch. It's more like I'm taking the demonstrations that are kind of trapped in this book that's meant for, you know, college level demonstrations and bringing it to the masses. But to do that, I have to modify them a lot. Like with the iodine clock example, in a lecture demonstration, you take two beakers, you mix them together and you get a color change. But for the Today Show, in that hour, it was Hoda, Kathy Lee and Hoda were the hosts. They have like this theme of wine on their show, and every show they drink some wine and blah, blah, blah. So basically I did that reaction in a huge wine glass, like can hold like a gallon of liquid. And so basically it looked like I was turning water to wine. And that's kind of what you have to do for TV, is you adapt the demonstrations from the book to something that's going to capture the attention of kind of a general audience or the millions of people that are watching that, as well as making it fast and fun. That's actually one of the biggest challenges. A lot of these demonstrations, they take, you know, 5-10 minutes, and you don't have that kind of time on these shows. You got, you know, 60 seconds per demonstration. So you gotta change the reactants, the ratios, the temperatures, the do it in different ways. And it's a lot of adapting and being creative in that sense.
Yeah. And the other thing I'd like to ask you about is, I know this, like I said, this develops over time, is you have this wonderful, you know, anybody that performs, whether you be on stage, you know, performing for a school group or, you know, on the Today Show or Rachel Ray or something like that, you have to have a persona and an energy level that's just, you know, way above like you and I talking right now. And you know, I'm just wondering, you know, how long did it take you, and you know, what was it like for you to develop that, you know, that Dr. Jeff, you know, that personality who's, you know, not the normal person that, you know, is sitting here talking to me now, but the guy who's got to go on stage and, you know, pull the audience in because, you know, you have to be a performer.
Yes. So the way I describe that, so the kind of the Dr. Jeff persona, you know, it's me. Like I'm not a trained actor. I don't consider myself to do acting in any kind of sense. Basically, it's just me turning up my excitement, my energy, and my passion up to level 12. So, you know, me sitting here with you, I'm just, you know, talking like a normal person. But my inspiration above all the other, you know, incredible people out there would be like Steve Irwin, the Crocodile Hunter. And I grew up watching him as a kid and just being really in awe of his passion for animals and how it was contagious through the screen. It made me love animals, and I had animal birthday parties because I watched his shows. And when he tragically died, I was crushed. I cried for days.
Yeah, well, a lot of us were.
Yeah, and I kind of take inspiration from him in that he was so passionate, so excited about animals. It was contagious, and I try to do that for science. You know, I'm passionate. I'm excited. I talk loud and I make big gestures, and I'm kind of try to make that passion contagious. Of course, I'm also inspired by people like Bill Nye. I feel like I'm standing on the shoulders of giants like, you know, him and Steve Irwin. But definitely as a kid, I would watch a lot more Steve Irwin. I did watch Bill Nye, but not as much as Steve Irwin. So that's my primary inspiration.
Yeah, I can see that. And I'm glad you're being Dr. Jeff at level, you know, 6 or 7 right now. Cause if it was level 12, it would be like after 3 minutes, I'd be worn out and, you know, be like, okay.
Well, your voice is like very calm and deep slow. So I feel like I have to match the tone, you know?
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Dr. Jeff Vinegar, AKA the Dancing Scientist, founder and CEO for the educational program known as Generation Genius. We'll be back after a short break, so stay with us. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. Let's return now to our conversation with Jeff Vinegar, the founder and CEO of the for-profit education startup Generation Genius that aims to put high-quality and engaging science videos into K-8 classrooms. When did you decide to turn all of this into Generation Genius? And explain to our listeners the concept behind the startup that you've got going.
Sure. So Generation Genius is a company that makes fun and educational science videos for today's generation, which is Generation Z. And it kind of follows in the footsteps of things like The Magic School Bus and Bill Nye the Science Guy and all these amazing shows that kids watched in school you know, 20 years ago when I was in elementary school, the teacher would cart in that TV and the whole class would get excited and you would watch those shows to learn. Also, you watch them on rainy days, but at the same time, also you learn from them. And basically the light bulb moment for before I say how it all happened, basically Generation Genius is trying to do that type of thing for today's generation. And now it's not on TV, it's a streaming platform on generationgenius.com. And basically it covers all the topics from kindergarten to eighth grade that you learn about in science. So we're talking about phases of the moon, the water cycle, ecosystems, every single topic. And it's made in partnership with the National Science Teaching Association, or NSTA. And so it basically tries to capture the fun and excitement of those videos from the previous generation. And it combines it with everything the teacher needs to make an effective lesson. So it comes with a lesson plan, teacher guide, discussion questions, vocabulary, paper quiz, online quiz, reading material, and more. And so basically it's a toolbox that a teacher can use to teach. It's not just a show, which I think kind of differentiates it from things in the past.
Yes. And let's go a little deeper into this, is that you mentioned, you know, it's not like a show that's like, say, on Nickelodeon or something like that, where, you know, you think about Bill Nye being on PBS originally or the Disney Channel, something like that. Explain to me why, and our listeners, why you think this is a better platform and has more long-term effect than if you just did it like a TV show.
Yeah, so TV shows are very effective at bringing huge audiences. But in order to do that, you have to kind of skew more towards entertainment and a little bit less towards education. And I kind of learned this the hard way, where at one point, a couple of years ago, I had Nickelodeon interested in doing a show with me. And me and my partner, Eric Rollman, had a show in development in the pipeline there. And it was very clear that to make a show happen on Nickelodeon, it needs to be 90% entertainment and 10% education. And that's just the way it is in today's entertainment ecosystem. But I can do something much different in a school where I can have a show that is 80% education and 20% entertainment. So the content I make would not compete well in the general entertainment world. But in school, it's really dominating because it was literally made for that audience and to be used in that place. And that's why you don't see, you know, teachers don't like just play Netflix during class because it's just entertainment. So we basically crafted it specifically for use in schools and nowhere else. It's also very, very targeted for specific grade levels. So to give you just an example, for example, Bill Nye has an episode on weather, and it's great, and it's about half an hour long, and it covers everything from weather, from, you know, what is a cloud, to, you know, pretty deep details that you might learn about in high school. Whereas what we do is we take that one topic and we cut it up into a different grade band. So we have three videos on weather. One is called Intro to Weather, and that's for kindergarten, right? It's like this is rain, this is snow, this is a cloud, this is the sun. And then at the next level, we have another video. It's called Weather versus Climate, where we describe the differences and talk about the instruments scientists use to study the weather. And then at the middle school level, 6 to 8, we have climate zones and ocean currents, and it talks about how air masses and how they move and how they form weather and the global ocean conveyor belt, which circulates thermal energy around the planet. I mean, that's stuff that like a kindergarten someone in first grade would fall asleep over. But because we have kind of chopped it up into these thin slices that follows exactly the science standards that teachers are using today, which have changed since the videos of the past, it becomes very, very, very useful to that teacher because they literally need to teach exactly the things that we're covering. So it's very useful to them.
Yeah, and without going too deep into the weeds here, because, you know, even I find it boring, is the next generation science standards. I wonder if you could give us, you know, because that's what you're using as your model for these educational videos. I wonder if you could give us, you know, just a quick version to explain to somebody who doesn't really know what, you know, what the heck the next generation science standards are. What do you think of them? And can you give us, you know, just a encapsulated view of them?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think most people are probably familiar with Common Core, which is basically the standards that teachers have to use for teaching math and English language arts. But Common Core does not have science at all. It's not even a part of it. Science has a separate set of standards called the Next Generation Science Standards, or NGSS is the buzzword. And basically about 40 out of 50 states use these standards. They've been around for a couple of years now. And they basically tell the teacher, like at this, you know, if you're a second grade teacher, it'll tell you at the second grade level, these are the things a student has to be able to do. They need to know the difference between living and non-living or whatever. And so we basically, to make these videos, we go to those science standards and we take every single standard and we make a video for it. And that's what makes it so useful to teachers. We cover 100% of the topics they need to teach and we cover nothing else. There's not a single video outside of the standards. Yeah, basically they are a little bit complicated to look at, to be honest with you. But they're effective. They're based on research. So the standards were created by a number of organizations working together, including the National Science Teaching Association. It was based on research. And there's a lot of evidence backing up that the approaches that they're using are effective. But at the same time, sometimes when you make things more effective, you make them more complicated and more difficult to use. And so Generation Genius also helps make it easier for teachers. Their teachers are very busy and they have a lot going on and they're overworked. And so if we can save them some time, it's also another reason why people come to us.
Yeah. And I would say that you do a very good job of taking, what would be very difficult to comprehend for the average teacher, even me, being a lifelong science teacher, you take all that NGSS stuff and you basically boil it down to it's integrated science. Here's how scientists actually do science. Here's right. how they collect data and here's how they go about the process of science, and that it's very integrated, and it's also, takes advantage of technology and instrumentation and all of that, and you make it quite understandable. I would like to say, just, to point out to our listeners that from my observation, it's very, very challenging for K through 8, especially K through 6 teachers to teach science at all. If they even have time to fit it in. And then they lack the expertise and the confidence to be doing any kind of demonstrations or really doing any kind of meaningful science in their classrooms. They may make an effort, but this, what you're doing, provides them with the structure to bring this all to life in their classes. And I'm wondering what kind of feedback you're getting from those teachers.
Yeah, the feedback has been the best part of doing all this. Sometimes when you're, working day and night and weekend and weekday, you kind of forget the reason I'm doing all this is to make an impact on the kids and the students. And when you get an email from a teacher that says, I thank you so much. I'm able to teach science more now, or my kids love science. They come in every day and they say, are we going to Generation Genius? Or, here's an image of my student who liked the video so much, they went home and did the DIY activity. And now they are going to science summer camp. So seeing the difference it's making is the best part of it. And, getting these emails, honestly, at this point, almost every day is touching.
Yeah. And I would like you to address the importance of your work. And obviously you've got a business and you're trying to make money, and schools, are also in a sense are a business, and they have to buy curriculum, they have to buy textbooks, so they have to be careful with their resources and what they're going to spend it on. And so when they decide that they are going to use your products, I'm wondering if you could comment on what is the importance of science literacy for children, especially now?
It's a great question. So I look at it more as students when they're in elementary school, that's the key age to where they can potentially get very excited and interested in science. And, that can lead to a career or respect for science in the future and things like that. So what we specialize in is trying to get kids excited and interested in science. And that's kind of where the videos play in, where, things are exploding and changing colors and fizzing and bubbling and there's jokes and there's, all that kind of stuff going on. It kind of captures their attention. Each video also has like a DIY activity that you can do in the classroom or at home using everyday supplies. So really our goal is to kind of get them excited, interested, and curious. I remember watching a Bill Nye video when I was a kid, and then I went to my garage and I did the little balancing thing he did with, some forks and a toothpick and a cup. And that just helped provide oxygen for the fire that was burning in me to do science. So that's really my goal. Is I'm not trying to replace textbooks or replace other curriculum. In fact, we are not a curriculum. We're what we call a supplementary material, meaning you use it in addition to what you're already doing. So if you're teaching a water cycle lesson and it's, maybe a little bit boring and in depth and, it's not exactly capturing kids' attention, you add into that a Generation Genius video and the quiz game, which kids enjoy, and that kind of stuff. And it helps bring that engagement, and as I'm sure you could probably speak to, engagement is just as important as high test scores. Because if you're doing really well in the subject, but you never want to do it again after you learn it, that's not that useful.
Yeah, and what I would add to that is it's so frustrating to me when I talk to young people and explain to them that the jobs, the great jobs in the future, and I have so many friends who are scientists, you know, dozens and dozens of them that are close friends. I don't know of a single one who doesn't love going to work every day and enjoy their work and find it rewarding. And, you know, the work they do is important and it's rewarding and they enjoy it and they get paid fairly well. And yet it's like so difficult to get young people to think of a STEM field as part of their future.
Yeah, and we have in our most recent series for middle school, we actually have a segment in every single lesson about careers. So if you watch a video about, you know, the electromagnetic spectrum, why would you ever need to know that? Well, there's some careers that use it. For example, a radiologist will use x-rays to check your bones. They use radio waves when they take an MRI of you. And even astronomers, they use light waves to look at up into the sky. And they use other kinds of waves like infrared and so on. So yeah, I mean, hopefully the dream is in 20 years, I get an email from someone and they say, hey, I grew up watching Generation Genius videos and that sparked my interest. And today I'm a professor at MIT and I just discovered blah, blah, blah. When I get that email, could be 30 years, 40 years, who knows? When I get that email, I know it's all worth it.
Well, I hope I'm still alive and that you sent and that you forward it to me, because I want
to
see
that. I'll try to remember.
And I think that's very likely to happen. Okay. Well, let's talk about the production of these, because it must be a tremendous amount of work. Can you give us a sense of how long it takes to go about making these?
Yeah, it definitely takes a lot of effort. It's probably basically 9 months to do every series, and we've done three of them so far. So, it's taken basically 3 years to make 117 episodes covering every topic. And there's about 50 people or so that work on this. And I mean, compared to Hollywood standards, that's considered small. Like to do something like we do usually takes 100 plus people. So, you know, we have to be creative in how we do things. But yeah, it's definitely a massive effort. There's a large team that works with me to make those videos happen. And I'm very thankful to all of them. It's kind of an interesting challenge in that, you know, at the core, I just want to be a scientist and help kids learn at a national level and that kind of stuff. But unfortunately, to do that, I also have to be involved in business and at the same time, because to do that production, you need quite literally millions of dollars. Because if you got to pay 50 people. I mean, it's simple math. You know, 50 people times their salary for 3 years is literally millions of dollars. And so you have to go out and raise that money. You have to pitch investors and go to meetings and convince them it's going to be a big thing. When somebody subscribes, there has to be a price for it so that you can continue to pay for more production. So we're going to be moving on to math videos that cost millions of dollars. And so it's kind of I'd say that I don't love being involved in business to this depth, but it's a requirement to reach kids nationwide and hopefully beyond, that I have to do that. And so it's something that I not struggle with, but that I have to do. And some of the people say, like, you know, why can't it just be free? And sure, I'd love for it to be free. I applied for a grant from the National Science Foundation. I got declined. So what am I supposed to do? Either not start it at all or take this other path where, you know, we have a month for free, no credit card required kind of stuff. We give it away for free to the schools that can't afford it. But at the same time, schools have a budget. Most schools have millions of dollars that they have available to spend on curriculum and supplementary material and their staff and things. And, you know, they find it worth it to pay for it. You know, we don't force anybody to use it. We give a free trial and teachers try it and they say, you know, wow, my kids are learning from this. It's saving me a lot of time. We have to get this. And they go to the principal and they do it.
Yeah. And well, you know, textbook companies don't give away their curriculum either. So it's just, you know, that's the way things are.
Yeah, it's the way the world works. And unfortunately, we just have to work. Well, fortunately or unfortunately, we just have to work in the way that we can't change the game. We just have to play within it.
Yeah. And well, you mentioned something it made me think about. You must have gotten a lot of no's along the way. And could you talk about, you know, the tenacity and the ability to just persevere and take no for an answer, but just keep plugging away? Because it's not like this happened overnight for you, is it?
No, definitely. I mean, if you trace back to the very beginning of the dancing scientist concept to where I am today, which is Generation Genius now reaches 1 million students every single week and into 20% of all elementary schools in the United States. That's 10 years of work to get to this moment. And hopefully I can, you know, take it beyond here. But it's a milestone I'm quite proud of. But to get this started, I had to go and pitch investors for money to produce the first set of videos, which was for grades 3, 4, and 5. And to do that, you send emails, you make phone calls, you go to places, you fly around the country to have meetings with venture capitalists and foundations and angel investors. And I had about 500 no's. And I have an Excel spreadsheet that I kept track of every single person that I pitched. And they just wouldn't believe that, you know, some biochemistry grad student is going to be the CEO of this company and it's going to be a big thing. And they just wouldn't understand. And so, yeah, I mean, I got 500 no's, but I got one yes. And that one yes was $1 million. It was basically a very prominent foundation. And the day that I graduated from grad school, the person from that foundation called me and they said, I got a great graduation present for you. We're in for $1 million. And that was really a highlight moment of the journey, because I couldn't have done it without the money to pay people to work on the project. And when people say, like, you know, what is it? People throw around the word, like, you know, I feel like $1 million. I mean, that morning I remember waking up and I literally felt like $1 million because I had just received the yes for the funding. And it was like that at every step. But now today that it's been so far very successful in its trajectory, I'm very proud and I'm very happy that all those people said no, because what it means is that as the founder, I'm able to have the control over the company and I can decide its direction and what we do and what we make and what we don't make. And if you take a lot of venture capital funding, those people control your company. And I'm kind of thankful that it turned out this way.
Oh yeah, that reminds me of a conversation I had recently with Andrean about the making of Cosmos, Space-Time Odyssey, and now Possible Worlds. Is when they pitched this idea to various networks, and you know, the same kind of people you're talking about. It was always, yeah, that's a great idea, but they wanted creative control, and she was unwilling to give that up. And it wasn't until Seth MacFarlane came along and said, "No, we're gonna pitch this to Fox." And you get total creative control and I'm going to help you. And at first she thought, well, you know, he says all this and sounds real nice over dinner, but he came through and they did it. And it's the same kind of thing. You have to have that control over what you're doing in order for your dream to become literally a reality.
Yeah. And those 500 no's, they really didn't faze me much because I knew that this was going to happen. And I put my own money, the first money into the company was my own.
Let's take a short break. When we return, I'll continue my interview with Dr. Jeff Vinegar, founder and CEO of the educational program Generation Genius that produces science videos for kids in grades K through 8. We're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's get back now to my visit with Jeff Vinegar. He turned his dancing scientist persona into a way to reach vast audiences on TV, but now he's turned his attention to K-8 science education. Okay, so tell me a little bit about the kids you work with, because they're actors, right? How do you go about choosing the actor kids that are going to be, you know, helping you present this material?
Sure. So in each video, we basically have three hosts, or me being the main scientist in it, and two co-hosts. And they're not assistants in any way. They are doing the science as much as possible. I have them do the experiments, and they ask questions, and I give them some hints, and they get to the answer. So it's a little bit different model than, you know, just dictating the information to the camera as a talking head. But to find these kids, well, they look like kids, we basically do casting here in Los Angeles or Hollywood, basically. We put out a casting call saying, you know, science show, and you get like 1,000 kids that apply, their parents and their agents apply. And then we have casting calls and stuff like that, and we find the best that we can. And there's some really amazing talented kids, and it's really hard saying no to some kids.
Oh,
and
yeah,
kind of cutting it down. That's really tough. But we also at the same time try to represent, you know, these days compared to the past, you know, diversity is more emphasized. And so when possible, we try to portray that on screen by having the cast represent what America looks like today. And we do get emails from teachers that are appreciative of that. You know, a recent one was, you know, some teacher who's a subscriber now says, you know, I teach in a school that's 100% African-American students, and they love this, and they totally relate to the cast, and that's powerful to me.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, sometimes people don't realize it's like you're a white male, but you know, you were born that way.
Yes.
It doesn't mean you're trying to take away and blow out anybody else's camera or candle, rather. You're trying to be inclusive, and you have all these wonderful kids that work with you. And I enjoy watching your interactions with them. Could you share with us maybe, you know, some blooper moments where you've like tried to do an experiment, maybe something pops to memory where you were trying to do something, it just, you know, didn't, it just went horribly wrong for at least that moment?
That's every single day in production. Yeah, so it's very common where things don't work, things don't go as planned, and you just gotta go with it. Yeah, the one that comes to mind is actually not so much a science experiment. It's when we were working with animals. So we do a wide range of things on the show, and we filmed most recently during the pandemic. You know, in masks with temperature checks and COVID testing and all that kind of stuff. And we had to move fast because we were delayed by 2 months. And then we had to get this stuff ready for September. It was really important to have it ready for teachers. We promised them it'd be ready. And so in one of the videos about classification of living things, we had an armadillo, and we had to classify it, you know, through the genus, species, all those different levels. And we got the wrong kind of armadillo. And it had this like crazy genus species name that I couldn't even pronounce. And the whole script had to be like redone because every classification was wrong. And so basically, we made it into a joke. During the episode, I mispronounced the name, and then I mispronounce it again and again and again. And it turns into this really funny moment where you kind of see like the scientist doesn't know everything. And then I pull out a piece of paper from under the table and I try to read the name from there. So it kind of like breaks the wall a little bit and lets people in that people kind of think like if you're a scientist, you know everything. And that's actually not the case at all. And I think I liked kind of showing people the other side of it there, that Dr. Jeff doesn't know everything. And that was clearly one of them. He had no idea how to pronounce this genus and species of the armadillo. And I still don't, but it made a funny moment.
Okay, so that was a great story. I enjoyed that. It reminds me of, you know, as a teacher, kind of what you said about you're a scientist and you're supposed to know everything. Every day when I was on campus teaching throughout 30 years, it would be like somebody, a teacher usually would come up to me and say, well, you're a science teacher. And then I knew, you know, there's some questions coming up that I have no idea how to answer it. You know, I don't know.
The way I explain that is people think it's like in a doctor, you have a general practitioner. They know a little bit about everything. There is no such thing in science. Everybody in science is extremely specialized. Me personally, my PhD, I know everything about this one a specific enzyme in the specific pathway of this specific organism. Not even that, I know this specific part of this protein. And I'm an expert on that, like the world expert at that one tiny, tiny, tiny thing. And outside of that, I'm not that knowledgeable.
Yeah.
It's like that with a lot of scientists. You know everything about a very specific thing and not much outside of that.
Well, one of the things I've noticed is I was kind of looking for you on Twitter and social media, and I didn't say anything. And I thought, that's interesting, because, you know, most of your YouTubers and science communicators, they're just real active in social media. And I'm wondering what's your take on that?
Yeah, so I'm personally not active on a personal level on TikTok, on Instagram, on Twitter. I mean, I have a personal Facebook for keeping in touch with friends from college and high school and stuff. But yeah, I'm not active on social media beyond that. I think it stems partially from having some early success on YouTube, which I guess you can call social media in a way. And in the early days of YouTube, I was getting, you know, millions of views, had 100,000 subscribers. Back then, that was a big deal. Now it's nothing. And that really didn't, like, you know, just having those big numbers doesn't bring you happiness, and it doesn't really mean that you're, you know, successful in reaching people in the way that you want. So I kind of felt like I had been there, done that, having some early YouTube success. And then I ran a different direction. Meanwhile, YouTube became much bigger. So I kind of ran the wrong direction in a way at first. And that kind of made me not want to, you know, continue with Instagram and Twitter and all those kinds of things. Cause it felt like a little bit just very self-promotional. Like I was just going to be constantly thinking about, you know, what's something interesting I could say in one sentence, and, you know, what's a cool picture that I have right now. I don't know. My day right now is not that interesting. I'm working on a computer. I'm hiring people. I'm helping with support. We're thinking about math videos. Like the day-to-day of growing a company is not Instagram worthy. And I don't want to be wasting my time thinking of interesting things to say and taking pictures of my food. I just want to eat my food quick and get back to growing this as big as I can to reach as many kids as possible. So it didn't do it for me personally. I mean, if other people are able to use those platforms to reach people in a positive way, more power to them. But what I have right now is a really powerful platform, right? Generation Genius reaching 20% of all elementary schools in the United States. And I'm putting 100% of my effort into it every day, night, weekend. It's really focused on growing that. So I guess that was a little bit of a roundabout answer to say that I think my time is better spent growing the platform that is my own.
Yeah. Oh, no, it makes sense to me, because you can just, you can find yourself just twittering away too much time on Twitter, where you could be actually doing something productive.
There you go.
I know there are a lot of great people that do stuff on Twitter that are good science communicators and draw attention to interesting work and findings, and that's all well and good. But
I think you kind of summarized it there, where I think I prefer to just be really productive in with Generation Genius. And if other people are able to reach people through those other platforms, that's great. I mean, science communication is an ecosystem, and there's people that are doing it through Twitter, through Instagram, through YouTube, through in the classroom. My route is through videos for the classroom, and that's kind of a specific niche that, you know, I'm kind of occupying right now. And I'm just focusing on my place in the ecosystem.
Yeah, and it's the best use of your time, which is valuable, and we don't want to use much more of it, because I know you probably got to go off and go to work. But before we let you go, for somebody out there, a parent, a teacher, you know, of a kid who's, you know, showing some kind of spark and interest in science, what would you say to them, but aside from, you know, watching your videos and stuff, to encourage them? What do you say to encourage parents and teachers to have children more engaged in science and enjoy it? What, just from your own personal journey and your love of science, what would you tell them?
I think the best way to fall in love with science is to do science. And I would even say that's even better than watching videos, even better than what I make, is to do it hands-on. And so that could mean, if you have a kid that's into science, to encourage them to join the school robotics team, to be part of the science Olympiad, to do the science fair in the summer, to join a science summer camp, or, you know, some kind of program at a university if they're in high school. And so I think the more that you do science, the more likely you are to be in love with it. And I think that's something I encourage, not to self-promote here, but we recently made a video called How to Be a Scientist, and it can be watched for free on our website. And I think that's a kind of a powerful one, where it shows, the different kinds of research that people can do. We basically go to UCLA and we interview scientists there, you know, broad diversity of fields as well as diversity of people. And we've got some really powerful feedback that's been really inspiring to kids. So basically, the more you can do science, the better.
Yeah, I actually watched that with some students together, and they really, really enjoyed it. I was very pleased at how much they engaged with it. Well, kind of putting you on the spot here. So if you can't think of anything, it's okay. But is there a really simple DIY experiment or thing that you can think of for a parent to do? Because everybody's trapped at home with their kids distance learning, that something simple to do with, you know, stuff people would most likely have in their house. What's a simple experiment or thing that they could do with their kid?
Sure. I mean, you typically you go to classics for the simplest things. There's always the baking soda and vinegar volcano, but I think everyone's heard of that. I think if you want to go one level deeper, there's kind of a cool color changing experiment you can do where you basically take baking soda and a Q-tip. And first you dissolve baking soda in water. You take the Q-tip, dip it in the baking soda and water, and you write a message on a piece of paper and you let it dry. And what that does is it leaves little streaks of baking soda crystals. And then you take blackberries and you rub it all over that piece of paper, and it actually will reveal the message in pretty colors. Like I think the where you wrote that with those crystals will turn pink and everywhere else will be green. And before you did that reveal, it looked like a white piece of paper. And so for kids, it's kind of like being a spy, kind of like, you know, secret message. And it also has some educational value. It's a chemical reaction. There's a color change at a higher level. It's a change in pH or acidity. So you can have like a nice lesson on that at different levels. It's also easy. I mean, Q-tip, baking soda, water, blackberries, $5, and it's, you know, accessible.
Yeah, that sounds like fun. I'm gonna go do that right after the show. Well, Jeff Vinegar, it was a joy to talk to you, and I just the best of luck to you with your projects now working on math for what you've done for science, and just good luck to you, and thanks for spending the time with us here on Blue Dot.
Thanks, Dave. I really appreciate you reaching out to me, and it's been an honor to be with you. I know that you are one of the users of Generation Genius, at least to some level. So when you contacted me, I was very honored to be doing this with you.
Yeah, and well, I try to encourage elementary school teachers to use it because they're the ones that they really need something like this. So if you know an elementary school teacher out there or somebody that's teaching from home with a kid and they're struggling to find curriculum, I think this is, you know, and this is something that's very affordable if you're just doing it by yourself, you know, for a school district's, you know, the affordable at their level, but just for an average person, you know, a parent trying to educate their kid. If you're doing it as a home teaching model, I think it's, you know, very, very valuable, definitely worth the money.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks again to our guest, Jeff Vinegar. You can check out free samples of his Generation Genius educational videos on the Generation Genius website, and I also recommend seeking out his earlier dance videos on YouTube. They're a lot of fun. You can watch his evolution from a kid who couldn't dance at all to a guy who can really bust out the moves with the best of them on a national stage. And if you know an elementary school student or teacher looking for science materials, I highly recommend his Generation Genius videos and the DIY experiments that kids can do while schooling at home or in a classroom. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented and very dry Northern California. We are distributed by PRX, and if you missed an episode or want to share one, check out our archives at mynspr.org. Subscribe to our podcast via the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fiddler. Our associate producer and owner of a dog named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.